I was brought up in a house that didn't have mains electricity until I was 12 years old. We were brought up in poverty, and it's overrated.
You're listening to Humans of Politics, a podcast about how it feels to be a politician. My name is A.B. Philbin Bowman, and my guest today is the British Conservative MP, Andrew Bridgen.
I think I'm a local guy that did well. Started a business with £1,000 in 1988 and built it up to a 27 million turnover company employing several hundred people in the constituency. And I think I got to the point in life where we all complain about things, don't we? And I think I was in the pub with a group of friends after the 2005 election. I'd donated some money to the Conservative Party, and that hadn't done any good because I think we only had a 0.5% swing to the Conservatives. And I was with a group of friends, and they always moaned, and I think it must have been one pint of Marston's Pedigree too many, and in the end I just said, well, that's it then. There isn't anybody else. You know, the seat that I was living in was solidly Labour, with a much-loved Labour MP, a local chap as well, and I said, well, you know, the council's co-terminus with the constituency, that's been Labour for not really been under Conservative control in 40 years, so I said, well, you stand for the council. As a Conservative, you stand, I'll stand for MP, and we'll take over, and we'll, you know, it'll be our problem, and we'll sort it. And we took the district council in northwest Leicestershire in 2007 with the biggest swing in the country. Took Labour down to, I think, 5 out of 38 councillors in one night, having had control for decades and decades. And I stood in 2010, the next general election, and took the seat. And I think when you stand in your home, being voted for or not voted for by people who have known you, it's quite a high-risk strategy. I think you either win or you have to move out the area, don't you, if they've rejected you. But fortunately, they didn't, and they returned me with a handsome majority. And my majority in North West Leicestershire has gone up every election since.
And how did that childhood shape the way you think about politics or the way you think about poverty or how to alleviate it?
Well, I went to a pretty tough comprehensive school, and that was a very comprehensive education. So what I think is I can empathise with people in difficult situations. I can talk to anyone from the road sweeper, the tramp, to the Queen and the Prime Minister, hopefully, and I don't think all politicians are able to do that. I had, fortunately, I'm the only member of my family ever been to university, and in those days I had a full grant because we didn't have any money. So I'm very grateful, and I think, you know, I've worked hard, paid a lot of tax and created a lot of wealth while I was a businessman, and I always wanted to give something back, and I think that's what I was doing when I went into politics. Since I've been the MP, North West Leicestershire's unemployment's down over 70% and youth unemployment's down over 80%. So we've got, you know, less than 1% of unemployment now in my seat. Everyone's, and I draw a huge amount of resilience and pride from the work we've done. It's not all down to me. They're very hard-working people in North West Leicestershire, but it probably wouldn't have happened without me. And you come into contact with people who, you know, through the casework, so a lot of it is really sad situations, and it can be tremendously emotionally draining. You know, you meet people with complicated lives and big issues that you just never meet in your normal run-of-the-day life, and it does eat into your emotional capital. I can remember one, I'd been an MP for about 2 years. It was coming up to Christmas, and we were in my office in Westminster, and the phone rang, and it was a doctor from Nottingham University Hospital. And he said, just out of the blue, and he said, I've got one of your constituents here. He said, and I need your help. And I said, well, what is it? He said, well, it's a very, very young child who's terminally ill, and is probably going to live for about another 5 days, and we're going to switch the machines off. And his dying wish is he wants to see his grandmother. And I said, okay, well, that's, what do you need me to do? He said, the problem is his grandmother lives in Albania, and she hasn't got a passport, and she'll have to have a biometric passport, And straight away I went and saw David Lidington, who was the Europe Minister, and William Hague was the Foreign Secretary at the time. And I saw him, and he was actually on the front bench, and I passed him a note, and I said, just briefly explained the situation, and he put a thumbs up. And I thought, well, she's going to go straight to the front of the queue at the embassy, and she's going to get this passport. And I was really quite cheered up. And the next morning, it turned out it was a bank holiday in Albania. And I'd even gone to the Albanian embassy, and there wasn't even anybody there. There was only a secretary. There was no, because they're having the same holidays in London, and it just wasn't happening, you know. And you know, it's just a couple of weeks before Christmas. This doctor rang me again on the phone, and he was really stroppy, and I'd really been busting my guts to get this, you know. I spoke to everybody I could speak to, and this doctor rang me, and he was on the phone. He was really quite sharp, and he said, "Oh, you don't seem to be doing anything. I think we're going to switch the machine off." And I really ripped into him, and I found it very, very upsetting. And in the end, what actually happened is that we did get the lady a passport, and she did get over, and he died a few hours before she got to the hospital. And I don't know, you know, where do you go from there? I mean, that is not a successful day, is it? By any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, that was quite a few years ago. Those are the sort of things. You know, there's no job satisfaction in that, is there?
That's absolutely heartbreaking. And I can see that you're still affected by it all these years later. Listening to that story, one of the things it underlines is just how slow and bureaucratic politics often is. And as somebody who went from the business world where you were running your own company, you know, you could make decisions pretty much on your own, pretty quickly, and start implementing them, what was it like to move into politics where, you know, if you want to change things, if you want to pass new laws, you've got to draft legislation, you've got to deal with civil servants, you've got to build consensus. How did you handle that change of pace?
You know, when there's 10 of you, you can have a staff meeting and you can change policy the way you're going to do something in the afternoon. The business had grown to a stage where it took weeks to change things, but then it was a quantum leap to politics where, quite honestly, you know, even a piece of legislation, it takes sort of 18 months to move through all its stages and become law. And the government is a huge oil tanker with a very small rudder. You know, to change anything, it is tremendously difficult. Normally in life, you look at something that it's not right. We need to improve it. We need to make a change. Then you make a change. And it is very frustrating when you think, well, this is not working. My constituents tell me it's not working. I've told the minister it's not working. This would be a solution. And it seems that everything you do is held back. And I have a saying that I came into politics to try and improve the lot of my people in North West Leicestershire and the country by doing good things. But I often feel I spend a lot of my time stopping bad things being inflicted on the country, often by my own government. And you'll say, well, stopping bad things happening and doing good, they're the same. But it's not as satisfying, is it? Yeah? And so I spend a lot of time looking at legislation and thinking, well, yeah, I know the intent's good, but look at the unintended consequences. My degree at Nottingham University was in biological science, but mostly genetics and behaviour, so I like the psychology. I like looking at laws and thinking, yeah, I can see what they're trying to achieve. It's not going to achieve what you want because people are going to do this instead, and that's probably worse.
We live in a very shallow social media age that can be very quick to outrage and very quick to jump on things. I'm just conscious that given the story you've told me, that the sort of the lazy stereotype of a Tory, somebody could look at you, oh, look at you, you're white, male, privileged, wealthy, which of course you are by your own efforts. But if they don't know that, they can very quickly stereotype you as something else. How does it feel to just be coming up against this misperception people have of you when you know the real life you've lived and the real story and the real people you've tried to help?
The people who say that, they don't know you. Social media, it's not social media, it's anti-social media, isn't it? I have a Twitter account and we do Facebook, but generally speaking, I transmit but don't receive. And sometimes I had an email which is rather nasty and you've got the person's mobile number and I ring them. And they're nice as pie on the phone. They would never, ever talk to you like they've just written in the email. But yeah, when people will say, you know, you're one of these Tories, or do this or do that or the other, I'm not doing this job for the money. You know, I was earning more money than I get now 30 years ago in 30 years ago money. This is not a job you're going to do for those reasons. Is there a huge satisfaction? There is, yeah. When I go back to my constituency and, you know, I go to the supermarket and people come up to you and all the time and will say, you know, thank you for sorting out my mother's council house front door, or getting my son into that school that I wanted to get them into, or helping get my mother an operation or whatever. And the sad thing is that we help so many people out of this office every week, but quite honestly, we've dealt with thousands since then, and I can't remember everyone, and that's embarrassing. But it's a huge thing for them, and that's really good that I'm approachable and they can come up to me and say all that. But I was given some very sage advice, like the first time that I was here, and they said, you know, the frustrations, sort of the as the casework with that tragic little boy that died at Nottingham. What you've got to do is, MPs do get thank you cards. We do get emails where people say, thank you very much, you've helped me, you know, I'm delighted with the outcome. We occasionally get flowers and bottles of wine sent to us. And my older colleague said to me, what you need to do is get all those emails and the cards and the letters of thanks for things you've done, put them in a file, and on the day when you didn't get the result you wanted and you don't feel, you said, you need to go and look at those and see how many people you have helped.
What in your personal experience informs how you see Europe?
Well, I got into politics. I was running my business, and one day a week I was chairman of the Institute of Directors of the East Midlands, and I got involved with Business for Stirling and the No campaign to keep the UK out of the euro. And I think that's probably coloured my thinking. I'm still completely of the opinion that had we joined the euro, that would have been a very bad thing for the UK. We tried to advise the Republic of Ireland not to join the euro, and I think, well, hopefully most people would think that that has led to certain problems which could have been best avoided. At the end of the day, I'm a Brexiteer, and I led the Leave campaign for the East Midlands. I was up against one of my youth heroes, Ken Clark. He was leading the Remain campaign, one of my next-door neighbour in Rushcliffe. And the East Midlands went with me and voted to leave by 59 to 41. It wasn't close. My own seat by 61 to 39. And I was never a leaver because of immigration. I mean, indeed, I'm married to an immigrant, because I'm one of those right-wing immigrant haters, aren't I, you see?
In point of fact, so is Nigel Farage and Donald Trump. So, you know, you're not alone there.
Well, it's...
I'm married to an immigrant too, by the way, for what it's worth.
Well, there you go, then. Don't knock it. For me, Brexit was always about sovereignty, and I wanted the people in North West Leicestershire and every other constituency to be able to vote for a Member of Parliament who actually did make all their laws, who then could be held to account for that at an election. And if the people didn't like the laws that I or my government were passing, then they vote us out and vote somebody else in who's going to make some different laws. That's democracy. That's full democratic accountability. You know, but when you ask the library at the House of Commons here, which is seen as a definitive, unbiased deliverer of facts, what percentage of the laws that pass through this place, supposedly the mother of all parliaments, the year before the referendum? And they said, well, it's 58% has come from Brussels. Well, I don't remember anybody in my constituency voting for 58% of the laws, and how can I be held to account at an election for things that I have no control over?
Do you have any friends from your time in business who are sort of saying, look, Andrew, we do so much trade with Europe that whatever about leaving the EU, leaving the single market and the customs union, all of that is just going to be economically so costly? I was wondering what kind of conversations you have with your friends.
I had dinner with a friend at the Carlton Club, which is a conservative club on St James, very famous, last night, and he is a financier, international financier, and he is an arch Remainer, and we get on really well. But we're never going to agree about the Brexit issue because we're poles apart. And it has really divided our country. Not so much in my seat, obviously, because we're fairly heavy leave. In my area, the East Midlands, I would say that the moderate Remainers have pretty much come to the conclusion now, this is what they told me, that we have to leave, A, because it was the Democratic majority, but also, you know, the relationship has deteriorated, unfortunately, during the negotiations with the European Union, to the point where to stay in now we would be a doormat and we wouldn't be able to say object to anything because the EU would just say, well, you had a chance to leave and you didn't. It would be a little bit for us now like returning to an abusive relationship. So we will have to leave, and I think once we've left, everyone should take some comfort from the fact that my experience of life is that things are never as good or as bad as people first think. Unfortunately, life is full of mediocrity, isn't it? However good some Brexiteers think Brexit's going to be, or however bad some Remainers think our exit from the European Union is going to be, it won't be neither of those things. And once we've left and that's settled, then we can pull our own country back together and unite around whatever the next challenge we're faced with. And also we can then have a proper relationship again, once again, with our friends in the rest of Europe. We can't carry on like it has the last 3.5 years. It's been very wearing. I've just spoke to a Labour lady MP in the lift, and she said, you look tired. I said, I'm not sleeping at night. I'm worrying about stuff all the time. And she said, I'm exactly the same. She's now on sleeping tablets. I don't want to go on to sleeping tablets. But the problem is, I'm so tired all the time. I now wake up in the morning feeling like I used to feel before I went to bed at night. You know, don't feel I'm getting any goodness out of it. And the atmosphere in this place is toxic. You've got so many people who have former colleagues in your party have left to go to another party. Party people left other parties. It's pretty toxic atmosphere to work in this place. It's been like that now for more than 6 months, and it's been getting worse for the last 3 years, and I don't think anyone can take much more of this, to be honest.
Final question. You've mentioned this toxic atmosphere, and I completely see what you mean. In that environment, any mistake which is made by one side is immediately jumped on by the other. And there was a particular incident where you were on a radio show hosted by the Northern Irish presenter Stephen Nolan, and the topic of passports came up. And most people listening have probably heard it because it went viral. For the handful who didn't, I'm just going to play a short extract.
Stephen Nolan on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Are you committed, Andrew, to ensuring that Northern Ireland is not treated differently to the rest of the UK?
I am, yes.
But the Conservative government already accepts that Northern Ireland is different. Because after Brexit, no matter what happens, people in Northern Ireland, unlike the rest of the UK, will still have the right to be EU citizens. That's your position.
Well, that's the common travel area as well, isn't it? We do have the right to go over to Ireland, don't we? As an English person, I have the right to go to Ireland. I believe I can ask for a passport, can't I?
Hold on a moment. It has nothing to do with your right as an English person to come over to Ireland.
I'm sure that currently...
It's nothing to do with that.
We have a reciprocal agreement where I can go to Ireland and ask for an Irish passport and someone from Ireland can come to the UK and ask for a British passport. We have that system. That's the system we have, isn't it?
Sorry, hold on. You think there is a reciprocal agreement where you as an English person can come over and get an Irish passport?
What was it like from your point of view? What went on in terms of the reaction to it?
Well, I'll give you the background to that. My wife had just given birth 2 days before, so I hadn't had any sleep at all. She was 23 hours in labour in St Thomas's Hospital over the way. I'd just driven up to northwest Leicestershire from London to do constituency work, and she'd stayed down here, obviously. And I agreed to do that interview, and it was after midnight. And we did have a bit of a spat, because I'm actually a qualified transport manager, and he was trying to tell me about cross-border trade, which I was in the food industry as well. And I got a bit narked with him, which I shouldn't have done, but I'm not making excuses, but I was dog-tired. And I made a major mistake. And every time I tweet now, there are 10 people who will tweet, Andrew, what about your Irish passport? But, I mean, those are the crosses we have to bear, aren't they?
Andrew Bridgen, thank you so much for speaking to me.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Humans of Politics Season 2. There'll be more from Westminster next week. If anything got you angry or got you thinking, all feedback is welcome. I am on Twitter as AB Philbin Bowman at ABIEPB. If you live in or near Dublin, our first ever live event takes place on November the 21st as part of the Dublin Festival of Politics. The lineup that evening includes a world-class musician, a former Taoiseach and Minister for Health, a TV presenter turned party leader, and a man who helped to transform Ireland from a country where it was illegal to be gay to one which voted by over 60% for marriage equality. Full details and tickets at festivalofpolitics.ie. Finally, you've probably noticed that we are living through a time when democracy itself is under attack and where political debate has become angry, distrustful and hyper-partisan. And I'm not suggesting that we can single-handedly reverse that with podcasts, but if you think that conversations like this are a step in the right direction and you'd like more people to discover it, the easiest and cheapest thing you could do would be to leave us a nice review wherever you listen. Thanks again.